You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Caden Tokawingua, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Caden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. E wha ake nei coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to MP Shannon Halbert about this year's Waitangi Day, seabed mining in Taranaki, and Labour and National's joint modern slavery members bill. And for International Desk, I spoke to Dr. Keith Rathbone, senior lecturer in modern European history and sports history at Macquarie University, about the controversy surrounding security at the Winter Olympics. For City Councilling this week, News Director Castor spoke to Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson about Auckland Museum, a potential merger of Kaipara and Rodney District Councils, and the opening of the Auckland International Convention Centre. They also spoke to Communications and Advocacy Manager at the Burnett Foundation, Kirk Serpis, about the decision to allow politicians to speak on the main stage of Big Gay Out this weekend. He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or waimairane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka awa e wari wari I ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano, he pakehiri rukiruki maronga I te pai, tukutuku o Erarangi Pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Last week was Waitangi Day, with over 35,000 people visiting the Waitangi grounds on the day. Politicians from the major parties were amongst those in attendance, with Labour and the Greens both using the day as an opportunity to promote their campaigns for the Māori electorates. The Fast Track Approvals Panel has turned down a bid from Trans-Tasman Resources to mine the Taranaki seabed. Greenpeace called the decision a massive win for people power and the ocean. And Label's Camilla Balich has lodged a joint members' bill with National MP Greg Fleming to combat modern slavery. The bill will make it mandatory for businesses to publicly report on identifying and addressing modern slavery in their supply chains. It will also make modern slavery a recognised priority area for the Human Rights Commission and change New Zealand's legal definitions of modern slavery to better align with international standards. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I asked MP Shannon Halbert about all of these topics. I started by asking what Waitangi Week was like for the Labour Party this year.
I always loved going north that time of year. It was through the Labour Party, actually, that I ever got to experience Waitangi. I'm from down in the Hawke's Bay, and so to go up there, celebrate the occasion, to hear the messages, the kōrero, the theatre, and see a bunch of whānau out enjoying and celebrating who we are as Aotearoa New Zealand, I think is quite a special thing.
Labour used Waitangi to promote your upcoming campaigns for the Māori electorates. Why are these seats important to Labour?
I think it's always important to have a voice for Māori. We've seen a lot of challenges over the last 2.5 years under this government where Māori have been attacked. We've seen the removal of Te Aka Whai Ora, the Māori Health Authority. We've seen attacks on the Treaty of Waitangi. And so it's important that that voice is really strongly within our democratic system, that groups of Māori are represented. And I'm really excited about the calibre of candidates that are wanting to stand for Labour to put our best foot forward to win those seats back.
What are your thoughts on the Māori electorate candidates put forward so far by Te Pāti Māori and the Greens? Will they be a challenge?
I think it's quite exciting that a number of Māori have put their hands up. We will be campaigning because, I believe that Labor can achieve the best outcomes for Māori, and particularly for generations to come. This is a serious election. We've gone backwards in so many respects. The government has promised to improve the economy and provide some respite for our whānau out there on the cost of living, but that hasn't happened. And so it needs a government with empathy, with action, and somebody who's actually going to get something done for the little people, the people on the ground, working people and people that need support. This government has been incredibly focused on landlords and tobacco companies.
And more specifically, what can we expect from Labor's campaign in Tāmaki Makaurau?
Labor's going through its selection process in Tāmaki Makaurau at the moment. That will be a few weeks. That's an opportunity for our nominees to get out to members to demonstrate to them that they are the best person to represent Labor and to be considered in the seat of Tāmaki Makaurau. So, you know, Tāmaki is very different to the other Māori seats. It's urban Māori. It's people that generally have less connection to their iwi and hapu. And, you know, that's largely impacted by some of the challenges of the cost of living in Auckland. And, you know, when I think of our young people in Tāmaki Makaurau, we have the highest number of young people not engaged in education, training and employment. So, you know, those are the types of issues that will come out as a part of that campaign.
And shifting topics, what is your response to the Fast Track panel declining a bid to mine the Taranaki seabed?
I think it's an excellent decision. You know, what I've seen is from the panel is very sensible, that they heard the concerns that were outlined there. And, you know, the fast-track process has been about putting profit over people, and we've always stood strongly against that. So to see that outcome offers a bit of hope. It gives me confidence that the panel are making the right decisions. Because most of all in there, our concerns have always been about the lack of protections for our taiao, our environment, and the ability to remove Te Tiriti o Waitangi obligations and partnership with Māori and some of the decisions that are being made.
Nearly 60,000 people signed a Greenpeace petition to ban seabed mining completely. Is this something Labor would support?
Well, Labor does support some mining, but we need to ensure that the right protections are put in place. You know, we need to make sure that our environment is cared for now so that in the future it is able to provide for future generations for our tamariki mokapuna. And so this is where the current government, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon, is really out of balance. He's out of step and out of touch with actually how do we ensure that we're protecting our future and not prioritising large companies, those that are wealthy, and not our country as a whole?
And I want to ask, why have Labor and National launched a joint members' bill on modern slavery?
I think it's great work that's been done by Camilla Balich and Greg Fleming. Because this is a concern that I remember coming up a good 10 years ago, and there was a lot of work done while we were in government back in, I think it was about five years ago. But we know that modern slavery does happen, and by putting this piece of work in place, it means that we will have consensus and the votes across the House for it to go through. It will be prioritised. And it gives the Human Rights Commission a formal role to play in this, and means that we'll have a register in place where companies, and large companies in particular, will have to register if there is an interest or a conflict with modern slavery issues in New Zealand.
How much difference could this bill make?
There's a lot of work to be done to protect workers' rights, and modern slavery is one of those. This is quite a narrow piece of work at this stage, but I hope that from here it really moves into a much broader program of work that future governments will continue.
That was Labour's Shannon Halbert on this year's Waitangi Day, seabed mining in Taranaki, and Labour and National's joint modern slavery members' bill.
That was our weekly chat with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Councilling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland Museum is in a precarious situation around funding, requiring significant support to manage the asbestos concerns of last year and other maintenance issues. Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown says the government should pay for some of the repairs, especially as they provide financial support for Te Papa in Wellington. Also this past week has seen proposals for a merger between the Kaipara and Rodney District Councils. This would split Rodney away from the rest of Auckland, a move with various pros and cons for the region. Finally, yesterday saw the Auckland International Events Centre opening after 13 years of construction. For City Councilling this week, News Director Castor spoke to Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson about each of these issues, starting with Auckland Museum.
Auckland Museum, I wanted to start off with. We've seen some financial struggles recently, leading the Mayor Wayne Brown to call on the government for increased funding. What would this increased funding cover?
Yeah, so the museum's hugely popular to Aucklanders, and really it's maybe our second national museum alongside Te Papa, in my opinion. And, you know, it takes huge amounts of tourism every year as well. And so that actually has the effect of degrading and increasing the operating costs of the museum, and also the need for capital investment into it to kind of refresh it and fix things and maintenance, all that kind of stuff. So whatever, wherever angle you look at it, costs are going up, and it needs to be treated with the same respect, I think, as Te Papa is in Wellington.
And how much does the council currently contribute? And could this council funding be increased as well?
Yeah, I don't have the figures just on hand, unfortunately. That would have been handy, so sorry to the viewers, listeners for that. But we are contributing substantially already to the upkeep of the museum. But my argument to that is, look, it's not fair on Auckland ratepayers to shoulder the entire burden of this when we don't expect the same from Wellington ratepayers and Te Papa.
And what's your view on how best to gather the necessary funding for the museum? Is it from the government?
Yeah, I think it is. And the government could look at investment in terms of its sort of tourism spends and its economic development spends. Auckland needs to have its fair share of these pots of cash. And so, look, the government should be looking at that first and foremost, I'd say.
Yeah. Moving on, we've also seen discussions of a merger between Kaipara and Rodney North District Councils. What would this mean for the regions and for Auckland Council at large?
Yeah, we've been down this road before a little bit. The Northern Rodney area has had sort of long-time grassroots activism to remove themselves from the super city. It'll be, you know, individual people will have different views about that. But I would just point out the kind of the financial elements of this could be quite tough on those ratepayers up in the north. And we've had previous evidence. They don't have the figures to hand, but their rates would sort of go up in a scenario where they were looking to leave. So, I just caution that, because coming from West Auckland, I know the preciousness of identity and the unique identity within the city. So I kind of understand how they feel, but I just argue that they should be looking at the whole picture.
We've seen concerns previously around Auckland's expansion northwards, and this seems to be something that would sort of amend some of that. Does the council have similar concerns about Auckland sort of spreading further and further outwards?
Oh, 100%, man, 100%. So we've been going through sort of multi-years of process around urban planning because the bad old days, decades of failures in our planning have resulted in continued expansion into our precious farmland and our precious green fields. And it's kind of time, in my opinion, that we stop that and we look to intensify in the inner city and in areas that can take the growth the best. And Rodney's a clear example of that. There's plenty of housing scheduled to come online in places like Warkworth, and honestly, look, I love Warkworth a lot. So, we need to be looking first and foremost at intensifying the central city areas, and that's kind of where I'm at as well. And I think a lot of people would agree in the rural areas too.
And looking into the central city, we've seen a big update there this past week as well with the Auckland International Convention Centre opening. What does this mean for Auckland?
Oh, it's great news, yeah. So we'll be able to attract more and more conventions to Auckland. and that has huge impacts on our economic development and our tourism spend, and it attracts tourists that hopefully will invest a bit of coin into the central city businesses. It's an exciting time, and that is tonight that's opening. So we'll see how it all impacts over the coming years, but, you know, another example of Auckland just getting better and better.
The deal was initially passed in exchange for an extension of SkyCity's gambling licence and the construction of some more slot machines. Are there any concerns about this?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's just me speaking personally. That controversy was sort of well covered back when those deals were signed, and I personally was not a big fan of that deal. But, you know, I'd also say that we have to make do with what we have now. We've got a convention centre that will attract, you know, great spend and great tourism to the city, and we should be celebrating that.
And lastly, with a new convention centre in the city, we can be expecting maybe some more traffic around people going in and attending events. Is the current transport infrastructure around the CBD strong enough to support that?
To be honest with you, I think the city centre transport infrastructure is some of the best in Australasia. We have an entire public transport system that is geared towards bringing people to the city centre. And I'd encourage people to take advantage of that $50 fare cap, weekly fare cap that we have. Jump on the bus, jump on the train, and get to these fantastic places in the city centre.
That was Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson speaking to News Director Castor about Auckland Museum funding, a proposed Rodney Kaipara Council merger, and the Auckland International Event Centre.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Councilling on 95BFM.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B and text in your thoughts 5395.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk are go.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Thousands of locals have protested the Winter Olympics in Milan, citing issues like the cost of living and the environmental impact of the Games, as well as the presence of law enforcement officers from the United States. Some of these officers are from a United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, branch focused on cross-border crime. The left-wing mayor of Milan, Giuseppe Sala, called ICE a militia that kills, while the Italian government has defended their presence. For International Desk, I spoke to Dr. Keith Rathbone, senior lecturer in modern European history and sports history at Macquarie University, about these protests in Milan and their broader context within Olympic history. I started by asking if he could go through the international security presence at the Olympics, especially from the United States.
So for this Olympic Games, there are about 7,000 or more officers involved in security, and a certain number of them are from the United States. And some of those officers, as we discovered earlier in February, even in the end of January, were coming from ICE, which is the agency in the United States that handles deportation, and is probably, many of the listeners are aware, has been involved in kind of mass roundups of immigrants in the United States. So the presence of ICE at the security for the Olympic Games has caused a lot of controversy in Italy.
How does this compare to security at previous Olympics, particularly at Paris?
So the Paris Olympics were in many ways one of the most securitized games of all time, maybe only topped by Beijing. For Paris, there were about 40,000 police officers that were involved, mostly from the French police and the gendarmes. And they were, I guess, most famously tasked with sealing off the Seine during the opening ceremony. So if you remember the opening ceremony from that games, then you would remember this amazing opening ceremony floating down the Seine, the major river in Paris. For that games, they had to block off the entirety of the Seine and making that area access only to ticket holders and to a small number of residents, which was, of course, a major change right in the middle of the tourist season in Paris, and did elicit a certain number of people who were upset and questions about the whether some of these security systems were going to be permanent in Paris.
What has the response been from locals to this game's security presence? Especially, I want to ask, what has the response been to the attendance of ICE? Because I don't think they were at Paris.
So typically, American security at Olympic Games is handled by the Department of Diplomatic Security. It's an organization that would protect American diplomats or other officials overseas. And I want to be very clear that this ICE agency, it oversees a lot of different departments. So when the news first came out, locals were incensed, and they've continued to protest up until the beginning of the games. The mayor of Milan called them an agency that kills. Of course, ICE has been involved in the death of two Americans and at least seven non-citizens living in the United States this year alone. But this particular group of people who work under ICE actually aren't involved in deportation proceedings, but look at cross-border crime. And so from the American perspective and a lot of Italian politicians' perspective, this is a different group within a kind of overarching group. But for a lot of locals, it can be hard to see the difference, and they wonder what the difference is and whether these people need to be in Italy at all. And so there's a kind of massive security operation going on, and locals feel it more and experience it more than others. Probably many listeners might have noted the kind of humorous reaction that locals had to J.D. Vance's 100-car convoy getting stuck in a small Italian road the other day. This kind of traveling security has long been a part of American political visits overseas as well. And from the American point of view, Olympians are kind of informal diplomats, and they also get protection from some of these same security organizations.
It's not just the security, but there have also been protests about the US presence at the Olympics more broadly, along with Israel, especially compared to Russia, for example. Can you give more information about these protests?
So there's a growing concern in the international sport community about the kind of imbalance in the way in which global sport organizations like the IOC or FIFA respond to violence. Now, both the IOC and FIFA have, as part of their charters, the mission to spread peaceful relations between nations. This is part of the modern Olympic movement since its foundation in the end of the 19th century. And I could talk for a long time about whether that's true or not, and whether that's actually part of their mission that they achieve. But there is a growing number of people who, on one hand, are going, why are we excluding Russian athletes if our mission is peace? And another group of people who are going, we should exclude any belligerent, any athletes from any nation that's been belligerent. And so we'll point to both the United States bombing of Iran, the recent kidnapping of the president of Venezuela, and of course, the Israeli state's invasion and occupation of Gaza, and wonder why American and Israeli athletes aren't facing the same kind of scrutiny. Now, in some ways they are, and in particular, it's very hard for Israeli athletes to compete internationally. And so FIFA and IOC often get caught on the other side of defending Israeli athletes' right to participate. But this is an ongoing question, and one that's only going to become more prominent after this Olympic Games, but in the run-up to the World Cup in the United States, Mexico, and Canada, and whose relationship has become a lot more fractious since they were awarded that, and especially up to the run-up of the 2028 LA Games.
Is there anything else people should know about the protests at this Olympics? And also, of course, what this means for the next Summer Olympics, which is being hosted in the United States?
People should know that protest has always been a part of the Olympic Games, and that locals protesting the Games has a long history that can be connected to protests around the athletes and the countries that they're from. And so directly related to the geopolitics of those countries. And they're often also related to the ways in which hosting mega events can have negative consequences for local communities. Now, Milan Cortina is maybe less damaging to local communities than other games. But all of these things ratchet up during the games themselves as local people find themselves kind of in the center of attention and use that as a way to make their voices louder, so they magnify themselves in the context of the games. And the IOC hates this. They hate that the games become politicized by athletes. They hate that the games become politicized by local residents. But this is really important, and I promise that LA in 2028 will see these kinds of protests as well, if not larger protests.
That was Dr. Keith Rathbone, Senior Lecturer in Modern European History and Sports History at Macquarie University, on the controversy surrounding security at the ongoing Winter Olympics.
International Desk on 95 BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts, 5395. This is Movies from Wiseblood.
There's no book.
Max the Jury is heading to New Zealand for the first time ever to show off his excellent new album, Alberoni. And 95BFM has tickets to give away to the show. If you have a B card, they could be yours. Just keep that dial on breakfast all week for your cue to enter. Max the Jury, Alberoni Album Tour, The Hollywood Avondale, Sunday, May 3rd. Tickets on sale now from livenation.co.nz.
Honk, honk.
The event of your fever dreams is approaching.
95BFM Drive Island with Greco Romank and CCTV.
Tomorrow. This room has a
We are happier than a sewer rat in a pile of slop to be unleashing the blistering CCTV and the debaucherous Greco-Romank onto Drive Island this summer. Will you come ashore?
And I got a fleet.
Drive Island at the Best Spot Morningside.
Tomorrow.
From 4 to 7pm. Thanks to McLeod's and New Zealand On Air.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God! It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
It's music.
95. You can listen to us while you're at home doing some chores, or you can take us along for company while you're driving in your car.
Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Well, if you want to save money and health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Thousands of locals are protesting, this year at the Big Gay Out. Politicians will be permitted to speak again at the main stage despite not being allowed to last year. Politicians and their parties have had a complicated history at the event, most recently with Prime Minister Christopher Luxon leaving after being harassed by protesters at the event in 2024. Big Gay Out has also been the site of other significant political action, including the Green Party's 2021 petition to ban conversion therapy. To discuss the decision and the importance of linking queer events with politics, News Director Caster spoke to Communications and Advocacy Manager at the Burnett Foundation, Kirk Serpis.
Politicians are speaking at the main stage of Big Gay Out this year. Last year, it was the opposite, right? We didn't have any politicians on the main stage. What was the rationale behind that decision, if we're thinking back to 2025?
I'm not sure, actually, because I wasn't here at the time. It's just that this year we felt that, we kind of have to engage with the political system as it exists, and we're not having them there because we endorse their views. It's a chance to hold them accountable, and we can't hold people accountable if they don't show up. It's not new either. Just last year was an anomaly, I guess. They have been coming here for most of the time that Big Gay Out has been happening. And, you know, it's a chance for basically making our community visible in their minds as well. And also a chance for us to engage with them and, you know, talk to them about what's important to us.
And politics is obviously very important in discussions about queerness in Aotearoa with, you know, things like the Marriage Amendment Act only passed 13 years ago and still laws and legislation being passed today that is directly affecting queer communities. How important is it for, you know, queer people and politicians to be engaged in these conversations with one another?
Yeah, I think there's this old, I can't remember it exactly, but, the crying baby gets the attention sort of thing, and it's up to all communities, I think, to basically speak up as much as they can if they want the political system to work for them. And I think that's, you know, it's up to our community when we at events like this to basically make it clear what we want and also show that we are a large part of, you know, New Zealand. We are a large cross-section of society that has certain things we want, and you know, I think it's a sign for a good political system that you have people from all political parties engaging with your community.
And there's still a lot of homophobia and transphobia we see in our political space, in our political systems. We still have MPs in Parliament who had voted against same-sex marriage in 2013. We've seen our queer MPs be harassed within and around their work as it relates to politics. What kind of work needs to be done to make politics an environment where queer people feel safe, comfortable to participate and at every level?
I think part of that is exposure, as in people come from different backgrounds and they might not be exposed to the queer community from where they, you know, they, from their own background. And I think it's events like this normalize the rainbow community to people who, you know, enter Parliament and may have not experienced a lot of this stuff from their childhood or whatever. And it also, you know, gives it gives us a sense of like how many people are out there, and especially in, you know, in Auckland, a third of the population, and to see that there's 30,000 people coming to something like this, it makes them feel that, you know, that it's not scary, it is normal, and it is quite fun, and it's they don't have to fear and hate this community.
Hmm. And if we're thinking about this government now, we've seen this government pass changes to the relationships and sexuality education curriculum. We've seen the puberty blockers ban looked into last year and passed. Mm. We've seen restrictions on trans women playing in sports. A question I'm sort of thinking about when I think about all this stuff, and also I suspect multiple attendees of the event will be thinking about, is if we should be platforming politicians who have been passing legislation like this at the event. What would you say to that?
I don't think we're giving them a platform. I think we're giving people a chance to hold them accountable. They'll be walking around the event, and it's a good time to, you know, to talk to them. They'll have a stall over there, and you can go and talk to the health minister and raise your concerns about these issues. I think it's better to engage with the system than, you know, try and push them out of it. Because at the end of the day, you know, our views are what most New Zealanders believe. It is the, you know, a small minority that are against these things. The idea that, you know, all people should be treated fairly is what most New Zealanders want. And I think that prejudice has no place in New Zealand society, and it's sort of making that clear to them when you do talk to them, and I think there are a lot of them out there open to engage with the public. So it's a good chance to sort of, you know, hold them accountable.
And if we're thinking back, you mentioned that you weren't part of the team back in 2025, but if we're thinking back to even further in 2024, when Chris Luxon was attending the event, he left early because he was confronted by protesters talking about various issues that the queer community has been facing under this government. Are there any worries that a similar thing could happen again this year?
Not really. I think we've put in place better systems so that, you know, they don't feel unsafe themselves. I think at the end of the day, everyone's coming there to have fun and, you know, enjoy the music and enjoy the celebration of diversity. And it wouldn't be right to sort of make them feel unsafe that they have to leave. I don't think there are MPs from all parties coming this year. There'll be a lot of them there from National, Labour and Greens and Maori Party, but some have chosen not to come, I think, because they feel unsafe, and that's a pity because it's, you know, we're missing out on a chance to actually talk to them and hold them accountable and also change, you know, help change their minds.
Given it's an election year, is there anything you'd like to see or hear from politicians for the queer community, right? We hopefully see some policies aimed at improvements, changing legislation. Is there anything that you're hoping for?
Yeah, we'll be quite publicly asking for a few things. One of them is, you know, a broad goal of getting to zero HIV transmissions by 2030. And our numbers have been coming down pretty well for the last few years. So it's something that's within reach, but not if we don't make an effort. And I think part of that is, once again, going back to that old issue of PharmAc and funding for new medicines and making sure that, you know, we have access to the same kind of medicines that most other OECD countries do. That helps a huge amount. They are the ones reducing stigma. And, you know, I think one of the things we've been calling for is the government to support the U equals U declaration. And that means that, you know, when the viral load is undetectable, it's untransmittable. So signing on that declaration basically helps a lot to removing some of the stigma from HIV. Yeah, so those are the sort of two main things. And the other one sort of just expanding testing so that, you know, the more we test, the earlier we catch the thing and the quicker we can move people onto the treatments. And that means the less likely to sub-transmit to other people because of the U equals U stuff. So yeah, those are what we'll be asking for. I think the government has signaled that they're quite supportive of most of those concepts. And, you know, there is a sort of growing consensus across Parliament that PharmAc is, you know, can do more to sort of fund newer drugs because it actually ends up saving money in the long term. And because the earlier you get people on treatment, the less serious the condition becomes and, you know, the cheaper it is in the long run. So, yeah, there's a sort of growing movement, I think, of recognition across parties that it's probably time for change in that. And, you know, that's not only an HIV thing. That's across the cancers and the diabetes and a whole raft of health problems.
That was Communications and Advocacy Manager at the Burnett Foundation, Kirk Serpas, speaking to News Director Kester about the decision to allow politicians to speak at the main stage of Big Gay Out this year. The event will be hosted at Coyle Park this Sunday.
We have a disaster. The southern border is a disaster. Hillary's a disaster. Jeb Bush wants Common Core. It's a disaster.
Common Core has to be ended. It's a disaster.
It is a disaster. Justice Roberts is a disaster.
Obamacare is a disaster.
Obamacare, it's been a disaster.
Unless you get hit by a truck, you can't even use it. So Obamacare is a disaster.
It's a total disaster. It's a catastrophe.
Rand Paul, you have to understand, is a disaster in the polls. He's a disaster on military.
That was The Wire.
Te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council's Shane Henderson, Macquarie University's Dr. Keith Rathbone, and the Burnett Foundation's Kirk Serpas. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4, but first I'm going to play some air to take us out for the rest of The Wire.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.